Copy, shift box.
Okay, radio check. Yeah, radio's working fine.
Yeah, call your personnel.
Yeah, copy, mate.
The chair in the vent bag.
Yeah, stitcher up there, thanks, mate.
Yeah, right, copy that.
What the hell is Westgold up to with the 100 million brick facility, boys?
Tune in to find out.
What
else we got, Matty?
Speculation, mate. OreCorp, AIC Mines. Oh, bloody, I'm going underground 2 days in a row. But Lens 6.
I'm going to touch on our good friends at PMET as well. And a bit of news from the Chilean copper giant Codelco. And last but not least, as we've alluded to, Westgold.
Yeah, boys. Bloody Google will provide you anything, boys. Google. Gotta love Google. Have a look at this fella. We're called a bloke underground with a sign. I love KCA. Mate, he must be either he's an employee or a, I don't know, that bloke looks happy.
He looks like he's just called KCA and he's had a great conversation with KCA. Mate. And KCA are coming to fix his problems.
Mate, possibly. But this could be anything. I'd love this bloke to get in contact with me and tell me what the message was. It might be the initials of some his wife or something. Who knows?
I think it's KCA Site Services.
It is. I'm going with it's KCA Site Services. And JD, you more than anyone know what KCA Site Services is about, but I'm going to tell the people that don't.
I'll let you
tell
you
what, ex-underground miners that take no is not an option. They do not take no for an answer. Mate, ITs, I'm going to flash them up, make it cinematic as hell. 7 new ones of these coming next year, the original F-Series. They won't be being made anymore. Normet material transport vehicle. Normets themselves, charge baskets. But wait, there's more. You get a free set of knives. And Sandvik 551 underground truck. Have a look at that beautiful thing that won't look like that ever again. Mate, they've got water trucks, surface stores trucks, 6 four-wheel drive buses to take people. And talk about people. They can provide people in the shape of that bloke, even a different gender, different shape. Like they can provide customised people to your site who can do heaps of different shit and you can pay them different. Like, mate, talk about an offering, KCA Site Services. And remember, boys.
Call KCA.
Call KCA. Every time you towel up a machine, they'll send you a new one.
Well done, Matty.
I love it. Now, we alluded to the potential positive protest last week at the Sydney Opera House. There was going to be a lobby out the front with everyone saying, I love Bondi, because he was featured at a bit of a lunch last week, a bit of a stock pick session, wasn't it, boys?
So what's the event called, JD? The
Son Hearts and Minds. So it's a conference, I guess, for charity. That's the ultimate cause, and it brings in all the big wig fund managers from across Australia, and they get often a big keynote speaker. So they had Dan Loeb, one of the the most famous hedge fund managers in the world, speaking, and of course Bondi was there.
And it even got a run on the Chanticleer podcast.
I must admit, I was listening to it on the weekend, the Chooks podcast, and very interesting to hear Anthony McDonald describe the audience to the Chanticleer.
Right, rip it for us, Trav.
James, I did not hear one mention of housing crisis, interest rates, cost of living, inflation, oil prices, any of that. It is truly the 1% getting together and talking about how to make more money together, I guess. But yeah, it was pretty buzzy down there.
Now, by 1%, is he talking about the 1% richest? But I think it's more talking about the 1% of best performing funds getting together, which I assume Terra Capital fall into.
That was my takeaway.
That was my takeaway. Top 1% natural resource fund.
That's what I thought they were talking about too.
But top 1% fund, but top 1% GCs as well. Like, could you meet, like, if you picked 100 people, 200 people, you'd be hard pressed to find 198. That are better than Langers and Bondi, like a portion of that 198. They're probably going to be the top two of the top 200. So there's your 1% right there.
Checking all the boxes.
Just tick, 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 tick.
Terra Capital, by
Terra the way. Terra Capital, by the way. Love your work. Righto, boys. OreCorp, Silver Corp. Drama brewing.
This one got announced when we were at Diggers, actually, in beginning of August. So OreCorp holding the Nangsaga Gold Project in Tanzania. And Silvercorp coming in with a scrip and cash deal.
Yeah, and the AFR is interestingly reporting that the OreCorp shareholders are questioning the merit of the merger with Silvercorp. The tie-up has been progressing. Scheme votes end for Friday, the 8th of December, so a few short weeks away. And if you remember, that deal was announced at Diggers this year. I think it was the 7th of August, Silvercorp being the successful party, and it was a recommended scheme by both boards. Happy days, right? So OreCorp has some pretty high-profile shareholders on the register there, including Nick Giorgetta and
Diggers
Timothy.
Diggers and Dealers fella, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Regis.
Regis, yeah. Yeah. And Timothy Goiter. So, like, you know, there's also some other entities on the register there. There's Federation Mining, which is Oz Super backed too, with about 11%. Importantly, when the independent expert opined on the transaction, they deemed it to be both fair and reasonable in their analysis. And the reason shareholders are reportedly a bit unhappy now, though, is because they're getting Silvercorp scrip in this transaction, and that company's share price has come off in the months since the deal was announced to market.
Yeah, that's right. So when the deal was announced, Trav, we saw 15 cents in cash plus 0.0967 shares in Silvercorp for each OreCorp share held. So that equated on the day of the announcement to about 60 cents for your OreCorp shares. And that was a 40-odd percent bounce up from the last traded price. Not that the trading actually ever got there. And like you say, since the deal has been announced, the Silvercorp share price has traded down, I think now down about 15% since announcement, which means the deal isn't looking quite as pretty, is it?
So yeah. is there going to be more interlopers, any other parties that might get involved here? What's the limitations? Yeah,
it's funny you ask that, Matty.
Or is it on the table?
And that's the question, right? Because if shareholders are getting noisy, if you've got some disgruntled shareholders, why are they getting noisy? Well, they want an uplift in value, right? And it's pretty late in the transaction timeline. They want an uplift in value. So if they want an uplift in value, how do you get an uplift in value? Well, you need either an interloper to come in and offer more, or you need the current bidder to actually put more value on the table. So to your point on an interloper, like, for example, could Perseus see relative value here on the table and they didn't participate before? There's a few things to consider when you like run with that line of questioning. The first thing to consider is that the deal was agreed with no shop, no talk, standard provisions, subject to customary fiduciary duties. So OreCorp couldn't actually shop itself around anymore, but shareholders could get grumpy publicly, which they appear to be doing. The other point too, though, is that on announcement of the deal, there was a concurrent placement whereby Silvercorp tipped in $28 million into OreCorp, and they ended up with a 15% ownership of OreCorp, which serves as a big detractor from for an interloper to actually get involved, because that 15% is likely enough to be a blocking stake from anyone else in a potential change of control transaction.
Mm. As we know, you need 75% of the votes to go your way on the day, and the turnout is historically pretty low at these things.
Yeah, and that leaves open the other question. So if an interloper might not come about, then could OreCorp shareholders get an uplift in price from here regardless of that? And I think that comes down to how many people could be threatening to vote no, right? So remember, for a scheme, Jada, you mentioned that number 75%. And as you mentioned, a lot of people can't be bothered actually voting, so you don't get full turnout. So it's 75% of the votes cast have to be in favour. And it's the turnout there that actually matters in the context of things. So I think I was trying to figure out what's the typical turnout ratio you could expect in a scheme vote. And I looked at two recent schemes of arrangement for ASX listed deals where the asset is in Africa. The two that came to mind this year were ACAP's merger with Lotus and Fortuna's acquisition of Chesser Resources. In the Chesser scheme vote, they got 40% turnout. In the Lotus one, they got 55% turnout. So based on that, I'm going to be slightly more conservative and say that OreCorp gets 60% voter turnout for the purposes of my analysis, right? That means that it would only need 15% of OreCorp's actual shareholding to band together and vote against to have a 25% of votes cast against, hence the scheme would not be approved if that occurred.
And that wouldn't be too hard to achieve. As you touched on earlier, there's some big shareholders in this one. You said Goiter, 5-ish%. There's a number of other substantials in and around that 5% mark. Giorgetta, 10.5% off the top of my head. The Federation Aussuper backed company sitting at almost 11%. So you only need a few of those to get on board and the whole deal could fall over if that's the way they want to go.
Georgetta plus Gordia alone is about 16%. And that
on that turnout.
Yeah, that on my assumption on turnout gets you a no vote. Plus there's other entities that sort of get involved in these times of transactions, including the M&A arbitrage funds, who will typically obviously advocate for an uplift as well because that's how they make money. The big question is then, like, does the Silvercorp actually provide an uplift because it's legitimately fearful that these parties would really vote against when it comes down to it? Or does Silvercorp think they're bluffing, right? And I think, let's think about this. It makes complete sense for shareholders to be noisy right now in the hope of getting an uplift in value from Silvercorp. But when push comes to shove, will they actually vote no? If the deal falls over, all Corp shares could fall back to where they traded pre-deal, and that's obviously a worse outcome for the noisy shareholders. So being noisy now, it could be a bluff if there's no better outcome for all Corp. But if there is a better outcome for all Corp and those noisy shareholders can see it in the pipeline, then maybe it's not a bluff. And whatever sort of Silvercorp interprets it to be a bluff or not kind of might feed into whether or not they actually provide an uplift in value here.
Yeah, that's the right question to ask. You know, are they just getting to the checkout and saying, hey, can we just see if we get a better price here? If not, you know, happy to go through with it anyway. The way I sort of look at it is you've seen All Corp just trading down and down and down for years now. It doesn't look like there was another buyer sort of circling at the time. But that said, it will get to a point where it's cheap enough. Tanzania as a jurisdiction has gotten more attractive over the intervening sort of period. So maybe, you know, the likes of Perseus, who at the time still had this Sudanese project that was, you know, their growth story, that's fallen through. Maybe they look at this. But other than Perseus, I mean, there's no other ASX players that I could see realistically would go for it. You'd probably have to look at a TSX or potentially an American listed company. But I think the number of suitors out there that could actually scoop this or would want to scoop this one up isn't an awfully long list.
So do you think like WAF and Resolute, for example, like they're just not WAF, big enough and won't want to take on the risk?
Well, WAF have their hands full developing Kiaka at the moment, so they won't want more development risk. Plus they're pretty set on, you know, being a Burkina-focused
miner too. Yeah, because the other end of the bloody country.
Yeah, it's a fair way away.
Yeah, good stuff, boys. The company that I felt that catapulted the podcast, PMET.
Our good friends.
Great memories. Oh, I love it. Right, haven't talked about them for a while. They've been sort of tracking along since the mineral resource come out. They've had a...
That's because of you can't drill in a certain part of the... I think, yeah.
What is it? So it's going into...
That wouldn't be
summer,
this time
so it's winter. So I think it's easier in winter because you can drill through the water.
Yeah.
So... New discovery at CV9, 14 Ks west of the flagship CV5 resource. Boys, tell us about it.
I mean, there's not too much to talk to here, Maddie. 18 holes were drilled. Three of them hit continuous pegmatite intersections of over 60 metres. So that's, you know, visual. They haven't seen the assays come back for that yet. But like you said, this trend seems to be quite a long one, 14 kilometres away from CV5 where the resource sits. But, you know, really... this has given them a good feel for what CV9 could look like. It was the first drilling that they'd done into it. Now they have a better understanding which way to point the drills and all that sort of stuff. They'll go right now 450 metres in strike, but they'll be able to biff that out in future and get a much better feel for it. But, I mean, it doesn't seem like lithium in the ground is the problem here. This was just outcropping again and they've just tested it and come up. They've got other things that they'll be developing in the background to get them closer towards becoming a lithium mine.
Well, and we're all waiting to see what Albemarle's strategy is with that stake they put in them.
Yeah, mate.
Keep your eyes on it. Oh, bloody computer turning off. What else we got? Right, AIC Mines, A1M, resource and reserve upgrade from Lens 6. So that's a deposit down deep, just offset from their deeps. The main cave, deeps cave, this Lens 6 reserve of 0.8 million tonne at 2.8% copper. So not massive, 22,300 tonne of contained copper, 18,000 ounces of gold, but it will bring up the pictures of it. The benefit of it is it's just to the side of the current development, so no new declines required. It's just more further access off the existing infrastructure. You don't need another ventilation system to ventilate it and things like that. So it's a bit of a good little add-on for them. So, boys, you can run your ruler over it. Oh, do you want me to start with the mining?
Give us the underground knowledge, Matty. You've dug into this one, mate.
You all over
is
it.
Is this segment just me? Is it going to chip in, aren't you?
I'll talk about the quarterly.
There we go. Right. Dave, you know what happens when you give me the microphone.
I'll be right here, mate.
Right. So let's get into some underground mining, money miners.
Tell us, Matty.
A bit of terminology. They started the underground development last month, and if you go down to, I guess, this paragraph I'll bring here, the Lens 6 mining method will be a bottom-up modified evoker method upwards from the Z305, that's the level, and longitudinal sub-level caving method downward from the Z305. So
that reads like absolute mumbo jumbo to me.
Oh, there you go. Lucky I'm here. So if you look at this map here, you can see this little pink point at the top of the deep, where that deeps is. So that's your 305 RL. So it appears they've sort of had to pick a starting point for where to start. So they've picked that point. They're going to start from there, and that's where above that will be this modified evoker, and below that RL would be a sub-level cave. So what is modified evoker? Do you know that one, Trav?
I actually don't. It's a mining method of some sort.
It is. So it's a stoping method. It's how you get the production out. So what it is, it's usually suited to mines with poor ground conditions. And what they do is, so Wattle Dam used it. Mount Charlotte were using it in their, I forget the name of the ore body, one section of the ore body. A lot of mines have used it. So what they do, they'll say fire 3 meters worth of the panel, could be 2, 3, 4, or 5, a small section, bog it out, and then probably just before they finish bogging out, they start filling it with like a cemented rock fill. So that's just waste that's been fired from your decline and your accesses mixed with cement, and they'll fill that void up with bloody that rock fill, and they'll finish bogging out and everything, and then they fire the next bit, just crush fire it against the rock, the cemented rock fill. So, and what that does is you don't open the full extent of the stope at once, and which creates the big hydraulic radius exposure, and you get a lot of dilution and everything starts falling in. So you're sort of supporting it as you go. It's a bit slower, but then you don't need to leave pillars either. You get full extraction of the ore body, and then you do that for the entire panel, like the whole level, and then you go on top and you drive over the drill it all out from the level above again, drop it down, repeat the process. So your bogs on top of that, and that's the bottom up. So you start at the bottom level. Once that's all filled, you go on top of it, sheet it with waste, go to the end, start again. That's modified evoker. But
I now know.
There you go. I'm hoping that made sense, because sometimes it doesn't make sense to me when I'm bloody saying it. So, but in this case, I've been told that AIC are actually their version of modified evoker. They'll probably fire the whole panel out, so like, you know, 20 metres or so, bog it all out, and then backfill it all just with normal waste, because the benefit, so based on that, I would anticipate that the ground conditions must be competent enough that they don't need to fill it as they go, and the fact that they're just, but the benefit for them, because the mine's nearly 1,500 metres deep, is that they, all the waste development for the declines and the accesses and the new levels, they can use that to fill the stope right down the bottom. And so it saves it carting it all the way to the surface, or all the way to some other intermediate tipping point they must have. So minimising the truck TKMs, that's a massive win. So that's obviously dictated using that method. And also, I'm not sure of the confidence of that whole area, how much it's drilled out, but where they're starting, so they're starting in the middle and they start working their way up. So you know you're in the ore at the middle, because you work your way up level by level, you can then just keep doing levels and drill as you go up possibly, and figure out where the extent of the ore body is. Because you remember with Galena, when I think they did their first production level and it reconciled very poorly, and the reason was that they came into the ore body too high.
Yeah.
And instead of it, they thought
instead
of it being this wide, it was this wide. So Yeah. But once you get into that top level and you're working top down, you are committed.
Yeah.
The only way to, like, you, if you, yeah, so that's what burnt them. So the way they're doing it, they've, it's a lot of operational flexibility to make sure they don't miss ore or start somewhere where there's fucking no ore.
Gotcha.
So that's, and then, so that's how that top half will work. Then the bottom half, they talk about longitudinal sub-level cave. So longitudinal means it goes along the strike, you'd say, along long ways,
yep.
Whereas transverse means you're going from like the hanging wall to the foot wall.
Yeah.
So longitudinal, all your gold mine, narrow vein gold mining, that's longitudinal because you're driving along the ore body and coming back in or going back out. So that's the same as what Big Bell use. The sub-level cave there. So you've talked about, and the reason for the best thing about longitudinal sub-level caving, it's the best way to manage the stress and the seismicity because top down from the center out to the extremities is the best way to manage stress. It's when if you start from the extremities and work your way in, you're coming towards a central pillar that you have to fire out and all the stress is concentrating on that area. But once you fire the center out, I'm pretty sure no geotech, but it like relieves the stress. It creates like a stress shadow because you've already broken that and then the stress distributes a lot better. So that's the benefit of that longitudinal method. So they'll wrap accesses around the end, meet in the middle, then work their way back out. But I think it's like a very, in terms of a cave, it's very, very small one, this one.
Yes.
But the benefit of it, you do not need to backfill anything. It's all just the ground just fails above it as long as everything breaks sufficiently. So that's what that deeps is. That's a sub-level cave. So it's like it's similar to that modified evoker in the – but you take away needing to put the backfill in. So it's a very quick way to mine.
Maddie, I remember when we've talked about Eloise in the past, you've always kind of made the comment that Queensland, it's pretty hot. It's pretty deep.
Yeah, it had a reputation as one of the hotter mines going around. But from what I've been told now that AIC, there was a refrigeration plant in there. Since AIC have had the operation, I think, for 2 years. So I think they've upgraded it twice and they'll, based on as they get deeper, sounds like they've got enough primary ventilation flow. It's the cooling that is the issue. So the deeper you go, the more auto compression of the air, so you need more cooling capacity. If they've got enough primary ventilation capacity, that's the air, but you need the cooling capacity. So I'd say the deeper they go with those deeps and this part of the cave, they'll probably have to upgrade it again that's what maintains that temperature below the max working limit of 32 wet bulb. So I'd say they'll be as long as they keep it below that, you want it at about 27 to 30. Like getting above 30 is starting to get bloody hot and tough on the workforce and hazardous.
Yeah.
32 is your stop work limit. So yeah. I'd say they'll have to upgrade that as they go down because I think that deeps, like you look at that drill hole they put out below it, like I think it just keeps going till you bloody meet some bloke with horns and a fiery face down at the core of the earth. But it's it's managing both the stress at that depth and the temperature to continue to mine that far. So there is a constraint on that. So, yeah, it looks like it'll go as deep and deeper than Gwalia, this one. So, right, JD, what's going on with the quarterly?
Let's talk about the numbers a bit.
I'll have a bit of my vape now after talking too much.
So the last quarterly, which came out in October, was actually pretty solid all around. They had record production, 3.4 thousand tonnes of copper in concentrate, as well as gold and silver as well. They also had record mill throughput, so positives all around there. The all-in costs were $5.16 per pound. And you compare that with the copper price they achieved at $5.95 a pound. So not bad, especially considering those all-in costs had been over $6 a pound in the previous periods. But if you look into the all-in costs, you can see that only 20% of the underground development costs are included, which ultimately means they're still paying out money above and beyond that $5.16 a pound. So all up, if you look at the cash position, starting the quarter and ending the quarter, it went from $30.9 million to $29 million, and that cash will be needed to develop the or expand the plant. They recently got Jericho on board that sits sort of 4 kilometres south of the Eloise plant. They're going to be bringing that in, development there as well, so that the cash is needed for all that sort of stuff. But hopefully they see, you know, economies of scale benefits, bringing down the unit costs from higher grade deposits like Len 6 from Jericho coming online. And, you know, fingers crossed for the company, they can see a bit of a tailwind from their copper price. And they've got a bit of a talk to that, given they're a relatively high cost producer. And that'll sort of set them on their way.
And once you're down that deep as well, I know this Len 6 is, you know, only 20,000 copper tons. But if you're pushing the decline and getting the accesses in, if you've then got another ore body to go to on that level, it might be, yeah, another 100 metres of access development to get there. But it's, that can make a big difference of having that extra source of ore for all the effort that goes down there. So it mightn't seem much, but it's a bit of a sweetener for mining at that depth.
And we'll have shown plenty of photos on the YouTube as well. You can get a feel for the images and the various little deposits and stuff that they've come across along the way, and they'll be hoping that can continue.
On cost, I wonder what the implications could be, like in the medium term as Mount Isa winds up as post Glencore's decision, because I imagine a lot of the mining services providers, you know, like you might have to go further, you might have to pay a little bit more to get some of the things that you typically relied on the service providers in Isa, who might close up shop as a result of that.
I think, but there's still a lot of operations there.
There's a lot of operations,
like
for sure.
The zinc's obviously still going for Mount Isa, but look, you got shitloads. You still got Cannington. That's a big operation.
And you have more people looking for work as well.
Mm. Yeah,
so yeah. That's a good thing if you've got more people available. So yeah. Especially in this environment, that probably naturally. The inflationary pressure of wages is when there's not enough people, so you've got to pay shitloads to steal people from other sites. Whereas,
exactly.
Yeah.
Let's talk about copper on the other end of the scale. So Codelco, the biggest copper producer in the world, they've announced that they're going to be expanding or putting more capital in the ground at Chuquicamata, one of the biggest copper mines in the world. So I want to bring it up because we said yesterday that Western companies aren't doing much on the copper front, more talk than action. But here they've put in another US $720 into this over 100-year-old mine.
Biggest, now, it's the biggest pit. It's the biggest pit in Chile, isn't it? Bigger than Escondida.
Yeah, and it's also underground now as well. So there's been plenty made of the declining output from these mines and Codelco in general, the rising costs, the big capex bills. I mean, we're expecting 1.31 million tonnes of copper this year. That's down from 1.45 the year before, and the year before that down from 1.61. So that is, you know, costs aside, the trend is not their friend there at all.
Yeah.
And it's been pretty well publicised that they're at 25-year lows in terms of output. So they're pretty confident they can get output back up to 1.7 million tonnes per annum by 2030. But that is just going to be very expensive. The grades are getting lower, the ore's getting harder, the mines are getting deeper. And we saw in the first half of this year, C1 costs jumped 41%. So those, you know, cost inflation issues that we talk about in Australia, they're not exclusive to Australia by any means. That's just an enormous amount of cost inflation for a miner
Isn't that 1.7 million ton target interesting, considering Escondida used to produce 1.4 million ton by itself? Just shows the scale of that operation.
That's a fun fact. Yeah, I didn't know that one, mate.
Yeah.
That's huge.
It's not producing that
anywhere
anymore,
near that.
That's what it, before the grades start declining, that's what they were producing.
Yeah. So over the past 5 years, if you look at the money coming in and the money going out of Codelco, they're relatively in the same position. Any of the cash coming in just had to go out for capex to, you know, maintain the lives and extend the lives of these assets. They issued bonds recently that priced them between 6% and 6.3%, which is, you know, pretty competitive. We spoke about MinRes doing around the 9% level, and they were sort of 10 and 30 year terms. So they're looking at the debt makeup of the company. This public group in Chile who analysed the copper industry, they're a government group, said that their debt level could get from US $18 billion today to US $30 billion by 2030. Yep. And that just, you know, that's a real reflection of how capital hungry these old mines are. On one other note, there was a lot made of the lithium movements in Chile in, I think, March or April of this year. So there was this big talk about the government going to nationalise it. That's not really how it's played out, but Codelco will have a role to play in lithium development in the country. So what I'm really interested to see is if this, you know, takes capital that would otherwise have gone to copper away and attention in general from Codelco, if that's, you know, shifted from copper to lithium. So it's still early days. We saw them do a deal for the small ASX listed group Lithium Power, taking that out. That's just the first step along the way. So all that said, you know, if the copper price were to start moving, it seems relatively unlikely that Codelco could have a massive, you know, response in supply and ramp up supply, just given how much capital needs to go in the ground for these ones.
Yeah. Imagine if Codelco, the copper company, became a big lithium player. People are known to have identity crises. they've got one step in the right direction.
Yeah, that's it. I think it won't be far away, you know, at all. They've got the Atacama Desert in their country, so good conditions for that sort of stuff. And we'll get into that.
SQM would be spewing, wouldn't they? Like that Codelco are now wanting to get into lithium, because they would want to be the Chilean lithium company.
They would, but there's a long history with government relations and SQM, so they're not in a bad position.
Are the government?
That's right. All the cash goes to the government there.
Yeah, very interesting,
lads. We touched on Westgold topping up the revolving corporate facility.
$100 million. I was going to say 100 million. Oh, no, sorry.
100 bucks. Nothing for a man like you.
We're going to miss it. So they've established $100 revolving corporate facility. They quote, now remember, they've got 217 million cash at the end of last quarter. Take away potential capital for like Grape Fingal and Fender restart. They have quoted an additional 100 million in additional, again, firepower to move quickly on opportunities we see emerging. What do you take from that?
To start with, it's an RCF, a revolving credit facility, which like they don't have to use it. They basically just
gives them ready to go.
For example, Perseus got a big debt facility like months and months ago and haven't put the trigger on anything, but it gives you optionality and it gives you firepower, and sometimes it signals intent to be competitive if there's something you're eyeing off and you want to be able to have kind of cash capability in any offer as well.
I think, didn't Jada, you mentioned Ramelius, they got one in place before they did.
Yeah, in 2022, so prior to Musgrave, although they do an acquisition every year, so par for the course there. I mean, the one that I think you're hinting to with your eyes there, Maddie, is Spartan.
Well, if it was anything else in the area, what Great Boulder and Aura and all that, they're what, 30 million market cap, so bloody premium. They could buy them for 50 each at this stage, and they've got that cash. You would think they've got their cash at already, but putting this facility in play, I think what Spartan's about 350, I think, market cap. I think it'd be about a $500 deal. Get it done. Did you like that?
Before we throw stupid numbers out there, full disclosure, we own this stock, so please discount everything we say about it.
Yeah, ding, 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 ding.
Oh, yeah, forgot about that. Yeah, we're all Spartan owls. That's why we're asking about the cost there.
And I'd imagine, Westgold would be, especially given how the share price has performed lately, they'd be incentivized to use scrip in any deal. So that, you know, wouldn't surprise me. It's at $2.12, I think, last time I looked, so chuck in a bit of that and you could get to that, but it'd still be a big, big bite. So I'm not expecting anything on that front.
So you can have the mix of scrip and cash with this bit of flexibility.
You'd have to for Spartan size at this stage, and given Westgold's cash. And I just think like Westgold historically bid scrip for their acquisitions and offers. And I think the learning, like watching Musgrave, remember Ramelius came in with a bit of a cash kicker. Was mostly scrip, but with a cash kicker. And I think just having the cash component to the offer can be more attractive when push comes to shove, especially if you're trying to go toe to toe with Ramelius again, which could happen given the regional interests.
I can't say I'm 100% convinced they'll be looking at like things like Great Boulder. I think they'd be looking at underground. They're branding themselves as underground miners.
Yeah.
I think they'd be looking at underground operations. I'm not sure if they'll be I assume they'd take a pit if it was there, but I think keeping that sort of underground niche, I would imagine, would keep the business a lot simpler.
Yeah, you know, agreed. And to your point, Trav, just look at the Orcorp Silvercorp deal, what we spoke about as well. A bigger cash component would look more attractive.
Yeah, yeah. And if I were a betting person, I'd bet nothing comes of this RCF for, you know, a long time. It's just optics, optionality.
It's no good for views. it's better speculate. Do you think there's anything else in the state?
Oh, probably.
That could be up for grabs. Not saying for Westgold, but do you think anything else is up for grabs? But we always keep going on about Spartan because it's on that pathway. But I think what else could be up for grabs?
I think so, but I just think I'd rather comment about stuff where you have synergies. Otherwise, a lot of gold M&A is quite, you know, it's like you talk about you're trading ownership, but you're not actually creating value sometimes unless there's synergies.
Yeah. Nothing like that. I'll keep throwing the line out, boys. You're going to hook on one day and just run with it.
Gents, we've got some BD to get to, I think.
We do.
BD. On that note.
and it will be beer drinking. I love it. Righto, Money Miners, Hooteroo, and we'd like to thank our bloody keeping the lights on us.
DSI, Underground, Terra Capital, McMahon Mining Title Services, Future Proof Consulting, KCA Site Services, JP Search, Brooks Airways, and K-Drill.
I love it. Righto, Hooteroo, Money Miners.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.